Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. This is show number 28. And this week we have Andrew Sanderson, who is an Ilford master printer, an author, a teacher, does pinhole photography. And he came on this week to talk with us a little bit about pinhole. No fun, but I'm back. Andrew, how are you?
I'm very well. Oh, you see, he's blown it now.
That's all right.
That's okay. That's okay. We'll just pretend you're not there. We'll talk to you in a minute, Andrew, if that's all right. Is that okay? You stay there and drink some Yorkshire tea.
I've got something to drink, but it's not tea.
There you go.
Well, I very nearly joined you. I've got some nice ale out in the garage, which has got my name on it. Anyway, Mr. Cannon, what have you got to say for yourself?
I'm here. I smell much better now that we have hot water after not having power for 9 days, but it's all right.
I was going to give you some abuse, but it's not very nice, really, because you had to put up with a lot with all those winds. And some folks died, didn't they? And so, you know,
yeah, it was pretty bad.
They're for the grace of God, really. So yep. you were safe up in the hills or wherever with your sister?
Yeah, for the most part, it wasn't really up in the hills. It was just a little bit up the coast, a couple miles. She just happens to be on a higher piece of ground than we do. And she has a little bit more secure home. So we packed everything up and just rode up there, and it got really windy and rained a lot and it was really loud. And then it stopped. And we had to clean up, you know, that's about how it goes. So,
and I think you said she was protected by trees. You had trees around you?
Yeah, she, her house is, you know, in the middle, well, that, kind of like a stand of trees, you know, like the edge of the forest type of situation, you know, around her house. And we have a little bit more of a clearing here where I am. So a lot of the wind was blocked at her house. I have some pictures I took. I shot some pinhole pictures at, I actually got developed today. They're hanging up and drying, so maybe it'll kind of help explain it a little bit, but we'll see.
That'll be good. Anyway, we did miss you.
Thanks.
Despite Neil Piper trying to take over, and Zeb Andrews seemed really keen to replace you.
That's flattering.
Although Neil, I have to say, Neil didn't really get a word in edgeways, because I had such a bad line to Cesare from Vermeer Cameras that he kept dropping out. And so he was still there, but I had to, every time I spoke, it kind of reactivated the line and he could hear me again, you know. But it
right.
And so I was having to try and second guess what he was trying to say. So he's a lovely chap, but next time we have him on, we must make sure he pays his telecoms bill.
Gotcha. Sounds good. But we have, for this show, our guest this week is Andrew Sanderson, who is a Ilford master printer. He is an author, a professor. You do classes, you teach, don't you, Andrew?
I do teach, yeah.
Yeah.
At universities up and down the country.
Wow, that's awesome. And you've been into pinhole for a while now?
Sorry, you went a little bit tunnely then. Go on.
You've been doing pinhole for a number of years, or?
Yeah, I started in 1980.
Wow. Yeah, that's wow.
I mean, I haven't been doing it continuously. I've had long periods when I haven't done any, you know.
Yeah.
But that's because I've been interested in lots of other things.
Yeah, sure, of course. I know you have three or four books out. Do you have, and one is night photography, one is like darkroom basics, I think it was.
There's one that's on alternative processes and hand coloring.
Yeah, that's what it was. You haven't put together just a pinhole photography book, have you?
No, because it's always been something that's been on the periphery of everything done. And I dip into it now and again, get obsessed, and then drop it and go on to do other things. But that's the way I am with most things, whether it be large format, quarter plate, 35mm, medium format, X-ray film, or whatever it is I'm using. It's a short-lived period, maybe 3 months or something, when I'm very intense on it. And then being a bit of a butterfly, I sort of skip off that and onto something. Wow.
Sure.
It's my interest up. I couldn't do the same thing continuously. I'd be bored stupid.
Do you have, other than being in the dark room and printing and being able to do that side of the process, do you have a favorite format that you do with Pinhole, or do you just kind of make your own cameras, or is it just kind of whatever you feel like picking up that day and doing Pinhole wise?
Well, I started with homemade cameras. I started with little ones, actually, little film pot cameras. I used to use a lot of graphic arts film, lit film, ortho film, things like that. And you could cut a piece, curl it round inside the film pot, you know, the nice black Ilford ones, cut a little hole on the side, and you get this lovely curved, distorted image. And what was great about the little ones was you could put them in inaccessible places, like in the bottom of a plant pot, looking up through a plant and things like that, where you wouldn't normally be able to situate a camera.
Sure.
I was putting those all over the place and getting odd distorted images. And then I think later on, I started making them large. I made a pinhole sort of box that went on the front of a Polaroid film holder. So basically, it was just made from a paper box, 7x5 paper box. But it gave me wide-angle pinholes on Polaroid. So I used that for a while with flash. So I could hold it up close to people's faces and things, pop a flash off and get a distorted view of a face or something.
Yeah, Justin Quinnell was talking about that.
He's been doing some interesting stuff with that. What was he calling that? Something ogram, horrible ogram or something.
Awful ogram.
I was going to say ugly ograms, but
I thought they were fantastic. I thought they were fantastic. Mine weren't quite as distorted as that, but it was just a means of doing things quickly, really, using flash, and because the flash needs to be very intense for with it being such a small hole, you can only do things really close. So. And I like the effect that you get with pinholes being close to things. So it suited that particular way of working.
Right.
But then later on, much later, I got into larger shoebox pinhole cameras. I did a lot of that. I made a 10.8 pinhole camera, which has got a focal length of 90 mil, super wide for 10.
Sure.
That's great. So it varies different formats. And then later on, I got one of the Mike Walker Harmon pinhole cameras, the plastic ones, which I love.
And, with the changeable cones?
Yeah, that's right. But I only ever had the wide cone for it.
Right.
And then the Ilford Obscura, of course, the one that's sort of foam core, which is a nice design, but you can only load one sheet of film at a time. And not.
See, that I like that design, that kind of like the box in box.
Yes, I do. Design. I like the simplicity of loading.
Just drop it in,
and
yeah.
And you're away. Yeah,
you can leave the house.
I actually like that discipline as well of just going out with one shot. And
me
think,
too.
Right, I've really got to think about what I'm going to shoot here.
I like it. I like it also. I've talked about it on recent shows.
Have you?
The ease of doing. Yeah, but
I don't remember you talking about it.
Close to about as much as you've talked about salt print, Andrew.
Well, it's often like the case with homemade ones, isn't it? If you make a homemade camera out of cardboard or something, I'm not talking about to the standard of some of these ones that some of these chaps you've had on, like Vermeer cameras. I'm never ever that standard. My woodworking skills are hopeless.
Mine too.
I just make things out of cardboard and use them for a while. But then you've only got the chance of one shot with those. There's never any way of any film transport or film holders. So
sure.
It's the same thing, one shot.
I got to that one shot mentality because I don't like dealing with film holders. They just are aggravating to me, you know. And if I was going out to shoot anything big enough to need film holders, I normally would end up taking more shots of the same thing, and then I ended up having two or three of the same thing. So I was like, why not just bring one shot in a camera and just do that one shot, you know?
Yeah.
Anyways, so you do a lot of paper negatives then?
I do, yes, but I don't actually use paper in pinhole cameras.
Oh, okay.
That's funnily enough. Most people do. But no, my paper negative work is, I like the creative possibilities of paper negative.
Sure.
And I like drawing on the negatives.
Andrew, it's one of the main things I wanted to quiz you about, really, was paper negatives. And,
okay.
And can you give us a bit of a masterclass free of charge on some hints and tips?
No, I can't, because I get very little work teaching people as it is at the moment. And if I give all my secrets away on here, I'll get none.
Right.
Oh, no one listens.
Yeah, there's maybe 10 people.
I do understand that you can. I'm just started playing with paper negatives with Ilford, just with okay. Ilford multi-grade paper, and reading the old Ilford manuals and things. Jack Coote, as I think he talks about it, and he's talking about shading on with pencils on the back to lighten areas so you can dodge and burn or sort of dodge by using pencils on the back, can't you?
Yes, you can. The creative possibilities are endless. It's absolutely fascinating when you get into it.
Yeah. What do you use when you do your pinhole and you're shooting film? Are you using Delta 100 or FP4 or what's your go-to?
I've been using... I've got quite a lot of it. I stuck with darkroom and film while everybody else jumped onto the digital bandwagon years ago. And what happened was a lot of my friends gave me all of their darkroom stuff.
Right.
So I ended up with boxes and boxes of half-used paper and all sorts of odd graphic arts films and things. And they're still in my darkroom. So I can just dip into one of those boxes, cut a piece of stuff the right size and use it. And I can process it very quickly, developer, under a safe light. So it's a very quick way to work, and I like the results. Once I start using proper films... we're talking about more expense, and we're talking about a more controlled processing sequence. And so I've generally avoided it for pinhole. I use proper film for 10.8 or 5.4, but I generally use graphic arts film when I'm just messing about with pinhole cameras. Cool. I have used some pre-cut ortho film. I buy 5.4 ortho film and 10.8 ortho film from Ilford sometimes and use that. But it's still something I can process quickly under red safe light.
Is it right. difficult to... Is that a very contrasty film, Andrew?
Ortho, no. Rate it between 12 and 25 ASA. I'm going to keep saying ASA today, not ISO.
No, it's fine.
Everyone knows it's the same thing.
I'm fine with that too.
Yeah. So it's between 12 and 25 ASA, and you pop it in Ilford Multigrade Paper Developer, normal room temperature for 1 minute, and you'll have a perfect negative.
Wow. And what cameras are you using that in? Are you using it in pinhole?
I'm using it in pinhole. I'm using it in an MPP 5.4. I've got a nice wooden 5.4. I've got a couple of 10.8 cameras. All sorts of things.
Wow. Awesome. Give that a go.
Yeah.
Sounds go on, Corey.
No, go ahead, Andrew. I was Mr. B. I'm sorry, Mr. B.
Yeah. So let's... Refer to me as Mr. B and Andrew as Andrew, just for this week.
Okay, just for this week.
So, Andrew, can you perhaps just share a little bit about your journey into photography? Because, I mean, I'm like you. I never moved into digital. That sort of craze passed me by. Mm. So what, were you given a camera by your father as a nipper, or what happened?
I borrowed... My dad was a keen amateur, and he... When we moved, I originally lived in the northeast, Stockton-on-Tees, and we moved when I was 13 to Yorkshire. And he didn't have room for a darkroom, so he gave up the camera club stuff. And a few years later, I had twin lens reflex and a Polaroid camera that he had just to mess about taking pictures of friends. So that would be 1973. Yeah, 73. And in 77, 78, somebody suggested I went to art college. And I went along to see what the place was like at an open day. Fell in love with the whole ethos and decided that's what I wanted to do. And we did 1 year of foundation where we tried everything out, but I knew straight away that it was photography that I wanted to do, specialising for the next 2 years. And it's been an obsession ever since. So I left there in 81, and it's been an obsession every day since then.
Right.
And did you ever work commercially, Andrew, as a photographer?
Yes, through the 80s, I was doing freelance work for local advertising agencies, design agencies, people like that, and doing a bit of portrait work and whatever I could get, architectural work, photographing pets, anything really. The stuff for the advertising agencies was well paid, but I got totally fed up with working for idiots and... Everybody wanted everything yesterday. They wanted you to work really, really fast. They wanted it for next to nothing, and then they wouldn't pay you for 3 months. They wouldn't even entertain a phone call for 3 months. You know, they wouldn't pay you after 3 months. You'd still have to chase them up. So the money management became really tricky, and keeping track of who owed you what. And I was always in arrears. So I stopped. I just thought, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not working for these idiots. So I gave it up.
And did you immediately start thinking about, you know, workshops, about teaching people?
No, I didn't have the confidence, actually, to tell you the truth. I was very unsure of where my work fitted in the wider picture of photography. This is before the internet. So I'm living in Yorkshire. I haven't got the money to go to London. All I see is what I can see in the occasional magazine. So I'm just working away, producing work, trying to improve, trying to get good at particular technique. And I think when the internet, I suddenly realised that there was a whole world of other people out there who were also cobbling cameras together out of cardboard and using pinhole and all these other things that are now very commonplace. But at the time, it was a revelation, and I didn't feel so much of a loner then. You know, it was a justification for what I was doing. By that time, I had a massive backlog of work, which, when I started putting it online, I got a fantastic response for. So the internet's been fantastic for me as an analog photographer, bizarrely.
I think it's well accepted by most film photographers that it's been a godsend, isn't it? You know, from I remember also the days before the internet. I'm not sure Corey does, being a...
Yeah, I do.
Being a baby, do you?
No, I'm not that old. I'm not that young, geez.
No, I know. Anyway, camera clubs, you see, that was my only interaction with other photographers, and I didn't much like camera clubs, but, you know, since the internet...
I generally stayed clear of them.
I think it was the competition mentality.
I'm nothing against them. I think that was it. I mean, I'm perhaps sounding a bit down on camera clubs, but I think they serve a useful function. But it didn't really appeal to the sort of work I wanted to do. Funnily enough, yeah. I do in quite a lot of camera clubs because I go and talk about my work. But I've never actually been a member of any one club.
Yeah, I haven't ever been in a camera club either.
Was it about 1988 that you, just recently, you shared a photograph made with, I think it was a 3x3 inch, I guess, inch pinhole camera with some bottles and some stone cottages on the back, which was just brilliant.
Thank you. And what I've always loved about pinhole is that infinite depth of field and the way that you can play with scale so that you can put something close and it becomes dominant in the frame. Ooh, excuse me, I've got a bit of wind. I've never been one for going to the seaside and just doing long exposures of water and making it go fuzzy. And I mean, loads of people do that. If it makes them happy, that's fine, but it's never been my kind of a thing.
Yeah, so you don't, be careful, don't to alienate half of our listeners here.
Yes.
So can I just say, Corey and I love water and pinhole, okay? Bright colours and things that go round like fairgrounds. We love all of that. Okay, carry on, Andrew.
The only time I did colour was when I was doing the Polaroid stuff, and that wasn't for very long, but it's mainly been black and white. But yeah, so mainly it's been about objects and trying to see it as a challenge to use this super wide, infinite depth of field camera and see if I can compose images that work. I mean, I tell you who's someone who's brilliant at that, and it's John Phobes.
Yes.
Look at his work. You know, he's been,
we've got to have him. I think I've reached out to him, Corey, and you know, he just makes beautiful compositions, doesn't he?
Yeah. Compositions,
He's on the Facebook group.
He is. Yes.
He does. He does a lot of great photography.
Composition is something that not enough people are paying attention to, even in the general photographic world. It's something that people don't seem to consider. I don't know why.
I don't either. I agree.
I think when I was learning photography and I just absorbed, I mean, I couldn't paint, I couldn't draw. I remember learning about perspective in art classes. And if anything, I think I was leaning towards, if I didn't fall into engineering like I did, I would have lent towards some kind of graphic architectural design drawing, because I was quite good at technical drawing, you know, and getting objects on paper and perspective was something I could sort of get my head around. And then as I started to, my father gave me a camera and I started reading books, you know, again, in the days before internet, then learning about the rules of composition. And then, of course, understanding through history how composition works in an image, but then of course breaking those rules as well deliberately.
Well, yes, it seems like at this point in time that everyone is far more worried about technically having a picture technically perfect as far as like exposure goes and like, you know, metering for it and everything, and you see lots of really technically wonderful pictures, but they're just, you know, there's what's going on, you know, I mean, it's just
there's a lot of sterile work.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like you can develop it perfectly and have everything just right, you know, but it just doesn't seem to, you know, it doesn't click. So I think composition is more important than everything is, honestly.
Pay attention to composition, pay attention to light, pay attention to the way that people view an image and the way that their eye travels around a print, so that you can control the way that they look at the image. You can make them look at certain things. You can suppress some areas so that they're not distracted by certain parts of the image. That's all part of it. It's all composition in camera, but also thinking about it when you come to print the image as well.
Well, that's the beauty of the darkroom, isn't it? I mean, I've been making darkroom prints for 30 years or so, and it's at control. Did I not mention that before? not to Andrew's standard, obviously. But
I think what you see a lot of these days is people will shoot on film, process it, and then they'll scan it, and they just invert it in Photoshop, and so they've got a black and white positive, and they think that that's the job finished. But it isn't, because there are parts of that image which are distracting that need to be subdued. There are parts of that image which are interesting and need to be emphasised.
Do you know, that was, going back to camera clubs, and I maybe had a bit of a downer on them, but actually some of the judges we had round were, you know, were really solid guys, and they would, you know, they would talk about your eye leading into the picture and some areas that were distracting, because perhaps they said, well, maybe you should have just burnt that area down a little bit to take the eye into the main area of the picture and stuff. And so I think, you know, that was probably one of the areas where I learned that as well from camera clubs, just from some of the better judges, you know, the way they critiqued your pictures.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think that's an area that, you know, banging them up on social media now, onto Instagram, people are generally nice. You don't really get any criticism, and criticism can be really positive, because it helps you build. And I think people are too frightened to say, well, actually, you know what, this might improve. Sometimes you see it, but you don't see very much sort of criticism. And I don't mean negative criticism, I just mean criticism.
That's what I liked about when I was in college doing photography. We'd have classes, and like every week we'd have an assignment, and then you'd have a group critique, and you had to have your picture printed and matted, and everybody put it up in front of everyone, and we all went through, and they're like, what could you do, this could be done, that could be done, and you know, and I really enjoyed doing that, because I mean, sometimes it was good, sometimes it was bad, but it taught me, you know, to really look at what you're doing.
And you do have, you have to be prepared for the negative.
Sure.
For the negatives. I mean, yeah. I went on a workshop with John Blakemore 2 or 3 years ago, and he looked at my negatives and said, yeah, well, I won't tell you what he said, but anyway, I felt a bit deflated, but then he encouraged me. And as I started making prints, he was very encouraging, and I came away feeling much better about it. But it was, you know, it can be a difficult process, but you've got to take it on board and learn from people who've been at this a long time and who know what they're talking about.
Even with pinhole, because, you know, I mean, it's so whimsical and kind of lighthearted, and I mean, it can be fun, but if you're really into it, you know, I mean, you're going to have to get into that eventually, you know.
Andrew, are you familiar with Diane Peterson talking about other people who compose, carefully think about their images? She uses her flat friends.
Her flat army.
I like her work, yes, and she likes my work, and we've commented on each other's work a lot. Yes, interesting work, and quite an unusual approach to pinhole photography.
Yeah, it is.
Yep. Cool. Well, Andrew, what are you? What's your favorite subject? I mean, do you have, whenever you're learning your pinhole camera, to go out and do anything? Are you doing, are you thinking about something that you saw somewhere else and you're going back at a certain time of day that you wanted to see a scene, or are you just kind of just whatever? Or...
I think it's dictated by how much time I've got or where I happen to be going. So when I'm into Pinhole, I'm thinking, okay, I'm trying to see things in a different way. I think that's what changing formats and changing types of camera makes you do that. It makes you start to see in different ways. So if I'm going out using, for instance, I've got a 5x7 camera and it's got a 240mm lens on it, which is a photocopier lens, or it's off some kind of a photocopier. It's stuck at its maximum aperture. There's no shutter, there's no control over the aperture. So I have to work in either with very slow emulsions, paper, or I have to work at a point where the light is low enough for me to be able to cap and uncap the lens to get the exposure. So when I'm using that, I'm going out and thinking a certain way. When I'm using Pinhole and it's super wide, I'm thinking in a different way. When I'm shooting 35mm, I'm thinking in a different way. So I think it's just you put a different hat on. You think, okay, right, what can I do with this? What are the possibilities? And it makes you think about your surroundings in a different way. So that it may be pictures at home, it may be pictures while I'm out walking the dog, or it may be that we're going off somewhere that day and I'll take it and I'll try it somewhere that I've never been before.
Are you working on any particular series of images? I mean, you live in a beautiful part of the world, don't you? You live in, is it the last of the summer wine?
Yes, it is. That's exactly what it is, yeah. I never work in series. I'm too, as I said, I mentioned before, I'm like a butterfly. I jump around with ideas and I can't stick to anything for very long. So I couldn't, if I had a great idea for a project through, I'd start it with enormous enthusiasm for a few weeks and then I'd get sidetracked by something else.
So actually Instagram is really good for you, isn't it? Because Instagram kind of lends itself to that, you know, to just putting different approaches up on there.
Yes.
Whereas your website, which I know is care of Andrew Sanson 2009, but it's... Yes.
Yeah. Well, the thing with the website is that I had a friend who had a great IT business and he employed loads of guys. And as situations changed, he had to lay a number of people off and it ended up with just being him and another guy. And then they parted ways and the server belongs to... Now, my website is on the other guy's server, so I can't access it and I can't do anything about it just at the moment. So it's that complication, you see. So I need to get into it. To get rid of it and pay someone else to do another one. And it's one of those things that I just think, I'll do that later, and it never gets done. So I usually say to people, just look at Instagram or look at Facebook. That's a better indication of what I'm up to and a better range of work.
That's true, but I'm still a great fan of even your older website because, you know, it shows you've got links to articles on there. You've probably got more stuff if you had a current website you could put on. But it's a great sort of one place to see everything, isn't it, really? You know, words and pictures.
Yes, it's always good to have a website to point people to. But I'm just that it's not up to date and I really need to do something about that. I really need to ask around if any of my friends are any good at it, really. It's just one of those things, as I say, just put it to the back of my mind. I have got a blog. Can I give my blog a little plug?
You certainly can, yes.
Right. Well, I've had a blog. I don't even know when I started it now. It's been going for quite a while, maybe 10 years.
Wow.
It's called thewebdarkroom.com. Oh, no, .co.uk. Thewebdarkroom.co.uk. And I'm not very good at keeping up with it, so there's big gaps between articles, but I try and keep it informative and interesting. So it's not just me banging on about something tedious. Hopefully the information there is something that people can use and put into practice.
Yeah, the link is on your Instagram title bit, whatever that's called at the top, www.thewebdarkroom.co.uk.
Thank you, that's it.
So, yeah. Andrew, do you do any contact printing style? I mean, you have to be doing if you're using paper negatives.
No, I don't contact print my paper negatives, but I do contact print my 10/8s.
Gotcha.
So I know a lot of people contact print paper negatives, but I'm lucky to have large format enlargers.
Yeah.
So the problem with contact printing paper negs is you never quite get the whole area completely flat, and you'll have pockets where there's a bit of a gap and the sharpness comes and goes on the image.
Sure.
Now, that's annoying. And so I've never liked that. So the way around that is to have a glass carrier in a big enlarger, put the neg in that emulsion side down, project it on a piece of paper, stop the lens down a little bit, and then if there's any unevenness in the paper, that's taken care of by the depth of field and the depth of focus.
Sure.
Oh, so you are using a paper negative like a conventional
just
negative?
Just like a conventional negative, yeah. Wow. So exposures are generally are in the region of 4 times what they would be for a film negative. So that's only 2 stops.
Right. I see. I've got a 5.4 enlarger, so I might try that. That's really interesting. Because I was just thinking of, you know, emulsion to emulsion and contact printing.
Yeah. Obviously, it's going to end up with little prints.
I was just asking because yeah. I've been trying to push everybody who's shooting film and doing it to get them to realizing that you don't have to have a humongous working darkroom to be able to make prints. You can contact print anything, you know. Just to get people out and trying to, you know, start making prints and stop just scanning.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right, Andrew. Andrew, who are you? Corey.
that's Mr. C to you, buddy.
Mr. C. You're both dead right. If you've got the benefit of having a large format enlarger, you can do, you know, you can use it like Andrew says and treat it like a negative. So with all the same darkroom controls. But I was, yeah. Jimmy Hickford, who's a film photographer and on Twitter and on our group, he stayed with me last week and he said, oh, I've got no room to set up a darkroom. I said, well, get yourself a 25-watt bulb and, you know, a safe light bulb and yeah. set it up and do some contact printing. And I said,
Corey, just a piece of glass.
Corey does that and he must have some way of regulating the height of it, you know, and doing a bit of testing.
Well, you can have a stacking system like people have in and out trays on a desk. You can have a stacking system where your developer's in the top tray, he stops in yep. the middle, and he fixes in the bottom, and that takes up very little desk space.
Sure, absolutely.
You can if you don't want to go to the expense of buying trays, go out and buy some cat litter trays. Yep. You know, you can do that. You can just get a sheet of glass, get a little 15-watt lamp.
I have a piece of, you know, probably 10 by 10 white foam core board. And I had a piece of glass from a frame that had chipped on the edge. And I have a glass cutter and I just cut it the same size, 10 by 10. And mm-hmm. I use those orange clamps that you use in like a studio when you're holding backdrops to uprights and stuff. And I just clamp those on the side and put the paper down the negative in the glass and just set it on the table. And I mean, and that's, it's not perfect, of course not, but it's got, I can print and hold something viable in my hands, you know, that's like straight from my negatives, you know, not just looking at them on my computer screen, you know. And
do you use a 15-watt bulb or 25-watt bulb? What size?
I use a 7.5-watt bulb.
Do you?
It is. It's kind of like an appliance bulb. You like you put like a refrigerator or something. I had to look for it, but I found one.
Yeah.
Because the problem I was having was with the 15 and the 20 watt bulbs, I only had so much distance that I could raise my light up. Right. And then I got to where it was 4.5 feet and I couldn't go up anymore. So I said, well, I'll just get a weaker bulb. And
have you made Corey, something?
There's a way around that, Corey. There's a way around that. Where your piece of glass is with your negatives and paper in, lay a few sheets of tracing paper on top. That'll cut the light right down.
Ah, that's a good idea. I didn't realize that.
How are you? Have you got your light suspended on something like a stand or that you can raise up and down? How does that work?
No, what I did was in my darkroom, I just screwed those hooks that you can like hang a plan on that have threads on one end. You just screwed it to the wood and then you can just hang like a plan on or like a string or something.
Mm-hmm.
I screwed one of those in and I literally took everything off of the light bulb base from the lamp and just hooked a wire over top of that and just let it hang. And
right.
I raised and lowered it. And then I finally got some, I ordered some 6x6 Ilford contrast filters.
Yep.
All right.
And the box that those came in, I went to one end on the bottom of the box and literally cut a hole a little bit smaller than 6x6 and cut a hole out on the back. And I took that box and screwed it to the ceiling so that the lamp could come inside the box. And then that's the box that I put my contrast filters in.
Right. If you're only contact printing small negatives, you could just lay the contrast filter on top of it.
I didn't think about that either.
Right, because you can get the large contrast filters, can't you? Which what are they about 15 centimeters across, something like that?
Yeah,
they used to make them that size, so you could easily lay that over a 5.4 negative, right, if you were contact printing it.
That's a good idea. I didn't even think about that. I was rather proud of myself with the box thing I came.
No, that's great. Yeah, that's great, because it wouldn't get too hot with a lamp that small, would it?
And there's even longer periods of time when it's not on, you know, when I'm developing, so it's it never really gets hot, you know, it's on for 15 or seconds or whatever, you know. And then, but I have a proper enlarger now, so I've taken all that down, right, and as soon as it's cool enough for me to get out, I'm going to start you know, using it so I can stop a lens down and have a little bit more control. So
You can still lay your contrast filters on top of the negative, if you want to, can't you?
Sure.
If you've got big enough ones. Yeah.
Well, I have a slot now on the enlarger, so I can just slide it in, but I don't know. I'll see. Yeah.
Andrew, I don't know when I first became aware of you. It was certainly via the internet, I think, and we maybe engaged with each other, you know, on some social media or not. But I remember becoming aware of your home photography book. I think it was around the time when I was recovering from eye surgery, so I was kind of at home and kicking around, and this book popped up around about 2011, I think. And I've said to you before online, and I've said to others, how inspirational your book on home photography has been, and I've pointed folks to it. But what was the genesis of that? I can't remember, because I haven't looked at it in a while, but is there any pinhole work in that, or is it just, I think it's just about ideas, isn't it, really? It's
yeah,
more about
I don't
ideas.
Think there's any pinhole. Yeah. Well, I it started with the night photography book,
which is also brilliant. And
thank you.
That's just full of useful information.
There were two chaps in London who were doing publishing, and they were linked. I forget one chap's name, but the other one was Eddie Ephraims. I sent a bunch of night photography prints down, 10-8 prints. I'd previously sent them to Practical Photography, and they'd rejected all of them. They said they were not interested. So I was a bit dejected, and I thought, oh, what the hell? I'll just send it to whatever they were called, Argentum or something.
That's right, yep.
And I sent them off and didn't hear anything from them for about 3 years. Nothing at all. And then I just got a phone call out of the blue from this other guy whose name I'm afraid I can't remember. And he said, oh, I've finally tracked you down. He says, I've been, we parted our ways, me and Eddie. I've got your prints. Would you like to do a book? And I went, yeah. Right. So that was it, really. And it's basically, I just had to get my head down and write a lot of stuff and illustrate the techniques. And anyway, so that came about. And then talking to them about doing that, I actually ended up working with Eddie again. And he said, he looked through my work and he said, you know, I think there's a book here in this other stuff that you're doing around the house. And so he gave me the opportunity to do a book on home photography, which was great. So, and because I didn't really know how it was going to be taken, you know, how people would take it, because there was nothing like that up to that point. And it was very personal, the stuff that I wrote in there. And I basically just threw everything into it and then put it out there to see what would happen. And it's been fantastic. I've had a great response from it. It's sold out now. It's out of print, but I'm still very proud of the work in that.
I think I found there's a website I use which links secondhand bookshops around, in fact, around the world. I'm never sure how you pronounce. Yes.
Abe Books. A-B-E.
Yes.
Yes, it's very good.
And I got both your books from there. I think they might have, funnily enough, been shipped from America.
Right. Well, the American one, they've got different covers. They put them on the night book. It's white in this country, and it's minty green in America.
Oh, no, I've got the white one. I've got the white one then. No, it couldn't have
and
come
the home
from
photography is it an off-white creamy colour in this country, and then it's a burgundy colour in America?
Oh, no, I've got the English version. It's much more subtle.
Right.
But none of that brazen American stuff with all those bold colours.
Yeah. And then the third book was with the Rose Division, which is a different company completely.
Was it Argentum? Argentum, were they the publishers who did your first two books?
Yes.
Because it was Eddie Ephraims was editing AG magazine, wasn't he? After Silverprint sort of let go of it in the early days.
I think he was certainly writing articles for them very early on. I've got the very first
Silverprint manual
magazine somewhere. Silverprint manual, yeah. Somewhere.
Yeah, I have that. I have that in a folder, yeah. Which is a brilliant resource, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. So that home photography, now you look on, I was talking to Zeb last week, and of course he had a series with his pinhole at Housebound, and Monica, who's going to be on the show in November, I think, Dr. Mars Rover on Twitter.
I know the name from Twitter, but I'm absolutely rubbish at Twitter. I hardly ever go on there. Me too. I can't get my head around it. Can't
you're not the only one. I'm out.
Well, I don't understand Monica, how it works.
Monica has you can use it just to find her, because she has a website or a blog called The Smell of Fixer, I think it's called. But she, but I use odorless fixer, so that's kind of doesn't smell of anything.
Ah, you baby.
I love the smell of fixer in the morning.
Yeah. Come on, Andrew. Mr. B, get with it, you know.
So Monica did a series of images called Housebound, and using a pinhole camera. And they're just beautiful, just studies of light coming through windows and reflections. Yeah. And, you know, and every time I see that, I think of you.
Well, funny, I was thinking, God, this is about, it's got to be 10 or 15 years ago now. I was thinking about trying to record some way a child. Remembering rooms that I used to be in, and thinking, well, if I went back there now, they would look a lot smaller than I remember them, because of the us being lower down and everything looking different. The scale of things was different, you know, when your eyes are just level with the table and things like that. So when my kids were little, I thought, really, I should be recording the house on a camera that's set at that height, and what better than a pinhole camera?
Yeah,
that would give it like a dreamy. It would give a dreamy effect. It would have that oddness about it, and it would be, because they're a bit fuzzy and they're a bit distorted, they'd be from the height that a child sees, and I wanted to do it as a series. It never got started, and then it was gone. We moved house, and now I don't have access to that house anymore, and I didn't actually record it for the kids, but I had the idea. Somebody mentioned something. I was listening back to some of your previous podcasts, and somebody mentioned a similar thing. I can't remember who it was now.
I think it was Zeb last week.
Was it? Right.
Yeah, because he was flat on his back with yes. something, and so he started looking at the world differently.
Yes, that's right. And he did those great things about everything that he did in a day, didn't he? He did all those different shots,
yes.
Like having a shower and things. That's a fantastic set of pictures.
Yeah, I still want to see the uncensored ones. I think he should publish those.
I don't think we need to see those.
Yeah.
Using pinhole to capture memories or to evoke memories is a really interesting theme, because, as you said, that sort of dream-like quality that you can get.
It's the way we remember things, isn't it? If you think back to a place of your childhood, you sort of see it like a wide-angle pinhole shot, don't you?
Yeah. Neil Piper, Corey's stand-in, when he was first studying photography, he used a pinhole camera to do a series of images from a place in Scotland, I think, that had a particular effect on him as he was growing up. And mm-hmm. he went back with those memories in his head and shot with it might have been 6x9, possibly 6x6 pinhole camera to try and get that sort of memory feel.
Really, and he used the water from his house to do the developer, didn't he? What did he use?
He did. He used from his toilet, I think.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering why that print I got from him was kind of smelly.
Yeah,
it was too much.
So cool. There we go. The you were talking about laying tissue paper down on contact. Was it on contact prints to give
yes.
it?
Yeah, yes.
Now
you can get pads of tracing paper, which are they're matte and they're a kind of a plastic material. If you use old tissue paper, it's got a texture to it and that could print through, but the stuff that you get, which is a plastic material, that's great, so you can use that to cut down the light.
Because I used to like using bits of tissue paper and just exposing the print, just a normal conventional print, for half the time, and then throwing the tissue paper just over it randomly, and you get these areas of where the highlights bleed into the shadows. I think that's the way around. It's whether if you're diffusing the camera, then it's either the shadows into the highlights.
Okay, if you put a diffuser on the camera, it's the light that's spreading. So if you put a diffuser on the camera, your highlights spread. If you put a diffuser on the enlarger, your shadows spread.
Shadows spread, yes. And you get that, with putting your tissue paper onto the print on the baseboard, you get shadows bleeding into the highlights, don't you? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. And that's a lovely effect.
There was an interesting technique that was sort of fashionable late 70s, early 80s, to print with a diffused black. Do you remember seeing those images? If you're familiar with the picture on the front cover of Frank Zappa's Zootaloos, you'll know exactly what I mean.
Hmm.
It's a medium format shot, and the way that it's printed, the blacks just spread slightly. All the details there, from the shadows to the highlights, but the blacks are spreading a bit, and that's using a diffuser under the enlarger lens for part of the exposure, not the whole exposure, because it just fogs the whole paper. You just use it for a proportion of the exposure.
Yes, I think I used to increase the contrast grade a little bit, because it does soften the...
There are a number of ways of doing it.
Yeah, I'll come on one of your courses, I think. That'll be good.
Yeah, do that. Yeah. It's a good point now for you to give me a plug for my workshops.
Yeah, Andrew, tell us about your workshops.
I offer workshops in darkroom techniques and photography, film-based photography. God, this isn't very slick, is it? I'm just sound like a right amateur. Yeah, people come to me for all kinds of things. I did one yesterday on liquid light, for instance.
So, we were talking about that earlier.
Do you know, are you familiar with the work of Graham Vasey?
Yes, Andrew? I met Graham a couple of years ago. Yeah, we've sort of known each other online for quite a while.
Yeah, I'm mates with Graham. We meet up a couple of times a year, and he I think he's got a little relationship going with a local gallery, but he uses liquid emulsions.
Yes, he does. He's done some lovely stuff with it. Yeah,
and lots of ideas as well. You know, he's using building his compositions very carefully and using liquid emulsion. But he's a great guy and very skillful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful technique. It's something that I've just got back into the last few months after a long period away from it. As this happens a lot with my work. I'll dump something for ages and come back to it and then have to relearn it all over again because I don't keep notes. So I got back into doing liquid light and it was a bit of a disaster at first. But once I got my head around it again, I'm loving it now. Using some lovely stuff. So I'm going to stick with that for a while. Hopefully, if I've got enough time to do it.
I picked up the book again in my bookcase, the silver print book of liquid emulsion.
There's some good stuff in that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm.
So do you teach, you do specific courses on the use of paper negatives, and do you tailor the course to if somebody approaches you?
I run my course I don't generally do group sessions. Unless I'm teaching at a university. I prefer to do one-to-ones because I think people, if they're paying 250 quid, they want value for money. So if you've got a group, there's always somebody who's a little bit shy and questions, and I don't think they're getting enough from the experience. So one-to-ones for me, I can tell by the person's response how quickly they're absorbing the information, and we can take it at their pace and we can tailor it to their needs. So I don't say, week it's landscape or this week it's pinhole. People come to me and we can do whatever they want. They can change their minds halfway through the session if they want. We can just cover whatever technique they're interested in, and we make sure that they've got a grasp of it and produce some work.
Do you like have a spare room in your house or run a bed and breakfast and do proper
No, I'm not that organized. There are local, but my darkroom studio is separate from my house. It's about 2 miles away.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Make sure you charge Andrew quadruple what you would charge anyone else, because he's filthy rich.
Now you know that's not true.
Filthy rich.
I'm a Yorkshireman at heart.
Look at how many cameras he has. He gets drunk and buys cameras all the time.
That's why he's got no money left.
No, there's a master plan running through my life these days, which involves not spending money on cameras. Okay,
I think I've got to the point now where I've got everything I need. I shouldn't be tempted by anything else. But that isn't. I'm sure it's not going to work out that way.
It doesn't help by these sites that pop up, like just showing you what other people have got, or
yes,
emulsive sites for selling your gear and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I try and avoid looking at those.
I'm glad I don't even.
Yeah,
I don't even really do anything with straight photography. I only have one camera that I use, a Holga, and I have that LCA. And well, other than that, I don't even do.
Andrew's suggesting it might improve your seeing capabilities.
Well, that's why I started using my Holga more, and that's why I went ahead and and bought that LCA 120, was because not everything that I was looking at and seeing, would work for pinhole. I saw things that would make, you know, good pictures otherwise. So I said, I really need to kind of start like mixing it up a little bit and kind of doing that. So that's why I went that route and did that. So, I enjoy it.
Andrew, tell us a little bit about your relationship with Mike Walker, because I know he'll be listening.
Right. Well, I sort of got to know Mike through his cameras over the years. I can't even remember when it started. And I have a couple of friends who had his 5.4 cameras. I can't even remember what it was. He'll kill me for this.
No,
the model that had all the move.
Yes.
A couple of friends of mine have said that's the best camera ever made for 5.4. The things you can do with that are just fantastic. And
it's listed on his website, but I think it's never. I don't know whether
he can't make it.
He can't make them anymore.
Which camera is it? I'm not familiar with it.
Well, if you go on to Mike Walker cameras,
he can't make them anymore because the place that made the molds, the managing director threw the molds away. He thought he was tidying the place up. He threw the original molds away, and Mike can't make them anymore. So you can only get them second hand. Oh, that's a shame. I got to know Mike through that. And when I had my 5th birthday, which was quite a while ago now, I thought I would treat myself to a decent camera. Because all the way through from being a teenager, I've always had second-hand gear, broken gear, stuff from junk shops. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to treat myself for my 50th birthday. And I'd never had a proper 10.8, so I contacted. You make all these great 5.4 cameras, would you consider making a 10.8? Yeah, go on then. And 9 months later, it was delivered, and he just designed it from scratch, and it's fantastic.
Is that the one with the black frame with the cones that you can replace the cones, or the 10.8 doesn't have a replacement?
No, that's his pinhole camera. Okay. It's a proper camera with movements. It's a Walker Titan 10x8. Yeah,
okay,
fantastic
sure.
camera. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah,
and he engraved number one on mine, so it's the first one.
Oh, that's nice. Mm. But can you put a pinhole plate on it?
I could put a pinhole. I could. Yeah, it hadn't occurred to me. Oddly enough, hadn't occurred to me. But I don't need to because I've got a homemade 10.8 pinhole anyway.
There you go.
I just use that.
Awesome.
Because I don't know when Mike started his collaboration with Ilford with that 5.4. Harman Titan, was it called a Harman Titan? It was 5.4, wasn't it? And I had one of those, and I sold it, not because I didn't get on with it. I thought it was great, but I think I sold it to partly fund my Toyo 45A field camera.
Right.
And that pinhole, that 5.4 Walker Titan, Harman Titan pinhole camera, is crazy sharp. You know, sometimes I looked at it and I couldn't tell whether it was a pinhole image or not.
Wow.
Mm. Well, I'm testing a 4x10 for him at the moment. He's made based on that design.
I saw pictures of that on Facebook. He posted that to the Facebook group, I believe.
I just haven't had enough time to do it properly. I shot some stuff in, I think, June, and then the summer was taking up loads of things, and I haven't got back to it yet.
Well, post it to me. I'll be happy to give it a few if you want to send it to me.
Right. Well, listen, you come to me for a workshop, Corey, and we can do it together.
Okay, cool. That sounds great. I have a 10.8, 8x10, and hopefully in the process coming soon from Todd Schlim. He made me a 4x5, the box-in-box design. Oh. And I asked him, I said, hey, can you just blow this up to a... So I can use 8x10 in it, and he says, "Yeah, I think so." But he's got a lot of projects going on, so hopefully he's listening. I'm still waiting, Todd.
Well,
we said a moment ago about not buying any more cameras. I've got to say, I do love those Vermeers in the lovely colours.
Yeah.
Mm.
They're really nice.
Do you know what I'm staring at?
No, I'm not. I'm standing. I'm staring at a Vermeer 6x9 camera on my shelf.
That you on didn't get shelf? The anamorphic though, ooh. Did you?
No, I wanted a 6x9, and I had. I just wanted to try a different manufacturer because I had the Art Reality camera, and I've got one of Todd's, and I put my first roll through the Vermeer 6x9 this afternoon. So I'm going to go develop the film later.
Is it the green one?
No, it's a kind of yellowy color.
For danger.
But what guests normally do, Andrew, is send me something in the post. So, James.
Like a bottle of whiskey or something.
Yeah. Well, I did reach out to you and ask if you'd like to come on the show. So, James Guerin kindly, when he did a bit of repair work on my 612 camera, and when he sent it back to me, this enormous box turned up, and of course he sent me his prototype 8x10 camera. Wow. Made out of MDF, and it's got 5 pinholes on it, center one, and then
rise and fall for each side.
That's it, yeah.
Vertical and horizontal.
So at the moment, I played around with it a couple of weeks ago with some Ilford multi-grade paper, and
he's using it as an ashtray basically at this point.
It was a very I'm just ignoring you. It was much more fun when you weren't here.
You're dropping out a bit, Andrew. Your microphone or your connection seems to be intermittent. It's going a bit funny.
Okay,
he is definitely a little bit funny.
I'm definitely a little bit funny, but I've started off using, how's that, can you hear me now? Am I dropping off?
Yeah, good, that's better.
I put some paper into that camera with a 10-8 dark slide, and it was very contrasty outside. I think that probably didn't help, but I'm getting quite a lot of light fall off onto the paper. Some people have suggested a bit of pre-flashing. Others have said, well, just use film. So, but you, I think you've worked a lot with X-ray film, and Corey, you have, haven't you? So
I have used some X-ray film. Yeah.
10-8, yeah. 10-8 films. 10-8 films really expensive, and I just can't
be buying. Expensive.
Yeah.
Well, I can let you have some 10-8 film if you want, Andrew. That's fine. In fact, I was going to put a thing on Facebook soon because I want to sell a bunch. I've got far too much, more than I can use. And I've got just suddenly had a recent expense, which I won't do, but I need to start selling a bit of stuff. So I'm going to sell some of that great film. I'll be putting the thing on Facebook soon. So,
message me.
Yeah, I will do.
Special deal.
It's the trouble is, it's all about 20x16. Most of the stuff I've got, I'm gonna have to either sell it like that or cut it down. But anyway, I'll put that into Facebook post.
20x16 film sheets.
Yeah,
it's X-ray, right? You're talking about X-ray.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can cut that. You can cut that down, though.
I can cut it down, but I haven't got very many spare black bags to bag it up. You see.
Oh, I see.
Send him a black bag, Andrew. You know.
I might just drop in. I do actually drive around the sort of Home Firthy area fair bit on my way over towards Manchester and Liverpool.
Yeah,
I've seen the signs to it anyway, and I have been there once when Last of the Summer Wine was still on the television. Are you familiar with Last of the Summer Wine, Corey?
Oh yeah, I love that show.
You were in it, weren't you, Andrew?
No, I don't know what Summer Wine is.
No, I did. In the 80s, I did sort of follow them around a bit and take pictures of the crew and that. But no, I was never in it.
So that crazy camera that Mike is making with that odd format, what is it? 3x10, 4x10, or
4x10?
It's 4x10. He to make the dark slides for it, some 10x8 dark slides down the middle. He's a bit of a genius. Yeah, he's a clever bloke, Mike Walker.
But is how commercial is this? Because people don't have 4x10 dark slides handy, do they?
No, they don't currently. But Mike's making them, and
of course he is.
Ilford
make the film.
Do they that size? What for the special order ULF things?
I don't know. It gave me a little bit to fight with. So it's FP4 in 4x10.
Oh, well, wow.
Ooh. Yeah, I'm sure. But Carwin Davies uses it. Sketch for the 4x10 camera. Yeah, he buys it from Ilford. I'm sure he does. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I didn't know that. I thought Mike was doing what Kodak used to do, because they used to just invent formats so that people couldn't go and buy film anywhere else, like 620.
Yes, you know? yes. Yeah. Well, awesome. It's definitely available. But it may be
because it's quite wide, and is it the shape of the cone, the design of the cone, that gives the even illumination across the negative? Because a lot of those wider cameras have the curved plane, don't they, like realities and things?
Yes. Got it worked out that it gives a wide angle, but it's within the limitations of the fall-off, so you don't get any obvious fall-off. I'm not sure it's measurable. I'm sure it's measurable that there's a difference between the centre and the corners, but you look at it and it looks normal. Beyond that, you start to get the...
Well, if you have the focal length is long enough and you have the right size pinhole, you should be able to project
the image circle. Enough,
yeah, that's where it's... Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. No, I think Mike's got it worked out. It's... what is it now? Is it 70mm on the 5.4? I think it's 70mm. Equivalent of a 70mm lens.
Is it? Right.
I think it might be.
Yeah, so that's... so that's pretty wide, isn't it? I can't think what that is now on 5.4.
Well, it's 70mm on 5.4, but I think it's equivalent to about 18mm on 35mm.
Okay, well, yeah. Yeah, I saw. I think you put a test shot up of a street somewhere near you, didn't you, just a few days ago?
No, that wasn't done on that one. Mike Walker, prototype medium format 6x12 camera. There's only one of those.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that, right.
Yes, that was interesting to use. And I like that camera a lot. It's he's going to go into production with it to make the tools for it, to cut it, to make it in large numbers. But it's interesting.
I was getting the two cameras
talking about
up.
Making one. Yeah, yep. Making a medium format. He's been asking about what people want. So
cool.
That's on Facebook somewhere. You'll find it.
Awesome. Well, Andrew B.
I'm just trying not to say too much.
Don't worry, your presence is taking care of everything. Right. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for coming and talking to us.
Pleasure.
This is the part where we would like to give you the opportunity to point any listeners towards a webpage, anywhere where you'd like them to go and get in contact with you or look at what you're doing, your blog, you know?
The blog is www.thewebdarkroom.co.uk. And I put work regularly on Instagram and on Facebook, and a number of groups on Facebook.
What's your Instagram?
Oh, Andrew. It's Andrew Sanderson Photography.
Yep.
So that should be fairly easy to find.
Yeah.
Andrew Sanderson Photography.
Cool. I think if you just Google Andrew Sanderson, Sanderson, then all those options come up. I don't think there are any sort of movie actors or politicians.
Big buff guys.
Yeah. There's the odd strange character that pops up when you put my name in, but most of it won't be to do with photography.
You should see what pops up when you put Andrew's name in, Andrew Bartram.
Yeah, you get lots of War Boy Snapper references.
Yeah,
which awesome. Is where you can find me.
There you go.
If anyone's interested, you can find me at various War Boy Snapper locations. Corey, what about you when you're not dodging the wind?
I'm on Instagram at Pinhole Cannon. And on Instagram, I take care of the show's page, which is at the Lenses Podcast.
I thought you were ditching that.
I'm going to do one of the other. I'm going to fold them together somehow. I'm just trying to figure out which one I want to keep. But it's coming, because I've really been listening to everyone talk about Flickr. Yep. So I'm really planning on getting back into Flickr and getting everything revolving back around my website and trying to get away from Instagram a little bit.
Well, listeners, if you want to find us out there, you can find us on Instagram. You can also find us on Twitter at the Lensless, which is mainly me. At the moment, it's Corey looking after the Instagram. And on Flickr, the Lensless podcast Flickr group.
Yep.
And that's growing, and it's a place to view people's work. Yeah.
James is there. He posts pretty regularly on the Flickr, doesn't he? Yeah.
Lots of people do. Yeah, Zeb Andrews is a great Flickr fan.
Are they on the podcast page on Flickr, or are they just doing their...
Yeah, no, they're a part of our group.
Cool. I'm heading there. It won't be long. I'm just going to start showing up over there more.
No, I'm not sure we'll let you in.
All right.
And you can email us, can't you, Corey?
You can. At thelensespodcast@yahoo.com.
Mm-hmm. Or send a voice message via the Anchor app.
Although you're probably better off going through Facebook or Instagram, because we're going to have a show soon of nothing but missed emails, because we've had a few that haven't had a chance to read. So we're going to do that one day soon.
Well, but if we it's going to be a week where we run out of guests, probably. Or we do a separate show just for emails. That would be a good idea.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, our schedule is full. I mean, like, oddly enough, we had talked about worrying about not having people to come on, but it's kind of turned into...
Andrew, have you got any shout-outs of folk you want to point the listeners to? That's the other thing we normally ask guests.
I don't know anybody around here but somebody whose work I always find interesting is Scott Speck, who's known as Integrity of Light. He's got an amazingly wide pinhole camera, and it doesn't seem to have any light fall off. I don't know what he's playing about with. I don't know quite how he's got that, but his work is quite startling. Some of extreme wide angles.
I think I follow Scott on Instagram.
Yeah. And the earliest person I saw doing anamorphic stuff was Walter Crump. I don't know if that's a name that you're familiar with.
No.
I'm not, no.
Crump? Corey, spell it for Corey so we can put it into the show notes.
Walter, and then C-R-U-M-P.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Mm. All right.
So it's Scott Speck, S-P-E-C-K, who's known as Integrity of Light, and Walter Crump. And the other... names here in front of me, but they're mostly people that you've already mentioned or have been on the show. You know, Diane Peterson, Astro Beck, Abelardo Morel, Justin Quinnell, John Forbes, Walter Crump, Eric Renner, Scott Speck, Todd Ainsley, Isabel Kurz, Neil Piper, Andrew Bartram, I don't know if you know him, Todd Schlemmer, James Guerin, Katie Cook.
That Andrew Bartram guy, he's a real jerk. I want to bring him around.
Corey, did you notice on Andrew's list of eminent photographers and visionaries, my name was on there, but yours wasn't?
Yeah, I know. That's all
right. Sorry, Corey.
Okay. No problem.
Right. No problem. Time to end the show, I think, on that note.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
I'm just writing it on the end of the list now, Corey.
Yep. So thanks, Andrew, for coming and hanging out with us for an hour.
No, I've enjoyed it. It's been good.
Yeah. Maybe we could get you back in the future.
Okay.
If you have any pressing points you want to make, like you've moved my name above Andrew's on the list. So we have to notify everyone of that status change. So have a great weekend, Andrew, and everybody listening. And thanks so much for hanging out and listening and enjoying the show.
Thank you. Thanks for giving me the chance to talk.
We enjoy it.
You're very welcome.
Maybe Andrew B, you listen to what's the show, The Light in the Dark?
Oh, A Light in the Dark podcast. Yeah,
he does all darkroom stuff. So, I mean, Andrew could probably... Okay.
I'm on that on Sunday.
That's right.
I'm the guest on Sunday.
Yeah. So
it's called A Light in the Dark podcast.
Check that show out. That's
John Gregory. We give John a shout out.
Yeah. He's doing what he enjoys. So there you go.
Right. All right. Check that out. Thank you.
Have a listen.
Can I go now?
God. yeah.
Now I've had a shout out by Andrew Sanderson. I'm going to go and have a celebratory beer. And Corey, you can go and drown your sorrows.
Yeah, that's the plan.
I think we're all going to be drinking beer.
Yeah.
Excellent.
All right. Thanks so much again, and have a great weekend. And everybody have a great week, and we'll talk to you guys next week. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, guys. Bye. Thanks, then. Bye for now.
Bye. Bye.
There he is.
Really tired. I didn't get to. I didn't get home. Didn't get home till nearly midnight last night.
Hello.
Can you hear us, Andrew? Hello.
Hello, I can guys. Hear you there.
Which Andrew are you talking to?
Andrew S. Mr. S.
It says two people are recording, but I'm not hearing anything.
I had this last week, and then I just had to go again, Corey.
Just want to hang up and try it again?
Yeah.
Okay.
Send me a messenger message if you can hear me and I can't hear you.